Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Hey guys, welcome back to Storytime Slayer Podcast. I know, long time, no talk. I feel really rusty, so just go with me on this journey. Today I'm going to talk about a John Smith who had two missing wives. It's a really, really crazy tale. I actually broke it into two parts. So this is part one. Definitely listen to it first or you'll be totally lost in part two. And let's just, this story has a lot of meat to it. So I'm just going to jump in. Thank you so much for tuning in. As always, I would love a review and go check out Storytime Slayer on Facebook. Let's do it. Okay, so today we're going to talk about John Smith. This case started as a missing persons report for John's wife, Betty, but it actually turns into so much more. As I mentioned before, this story has a lot of meat to it. So I am just going to jump in and start with who Betty Fran Gladden Smith is and who John Smith is and how they met. So Betty was 48 when she met John. She had been twice married and divorced and had three adult children, two sons who I know very little about, and a daughter named Deanna, which was really close to Betty. And Deanna actually plays a really vital role in taking down John Smith. So Betty grew up a military brat, meaning she moved around a lot as a kid. But she eventually settled in Houston, Texas, and this is where she spent a majority of her adult life. That changed, though, in the late 80s when one of Betty's sons was seriously injured during his military career and sent to a facility in Florida to recover. Now, Betty's mom also lived in Florida and was becoming quite older and frail, so Betty made the decision to move to Florida and take care of both her mom and her son. After some time in Florida, Betty got a job as an executive assistant for a company, and that is where she met her third and final husband, 39-year-old John Smith. Now, John Smith was an engineer at the same company Betty worked at, so they didn't work like side by side, they just worked at the same place. Betty was 5'2", she weighed 100 pounds soaking wet, she had blonde hair, and she was absolutely beautiful, both inside and out. John, on the other hand, was a fucking nerd, and he looked like one. He was thin and lanky with red hair, freckles, and a bad haircut. I hate John. Betty was not immediately taken by John, but he kept pursuing her until finally she just kind of caved and agreed to go out with him. I don't know much about their short romance other than within weeks of dating, John and Betty decided to get married. The actual wedding itself was on a whim, and they did it during a little weekend getaway to the beach that they had already planned. So they actually eloped after only a few weeks of knowing each other. The wedding took place in May of 1990, but they didn't get to go on an official honeymoon because they had gotten married on such a whim. That was something John promised Betty that they could do later. So once they got married, John actually didn't want Betty to work anymore because he made more than enough money. He was bringing in around $120,000 a year. And in 1990, that was worth about $275,000 in today's currency. Betty agreed to quit working and everything seemed to be going great. Then 9 months into the marriage, February 5th of 1991, Betty is served divorce papers at home while John was at work, and she was completely blindsided. There was no warning, no argument, nothing. So Betty calls John while he's at work, and I'm assuming she asks him, you know, what the fuck? John immediately tells her that he'd made a mistake. He actually didn't want a divorce, and he begged her to forgive him, which she did. And 2 days later, they went and petitioned the divorce. So it was now water under the bridge, I guess. So just really bizarre behavior. Shortly after the divorce scare, John actually lost his job, which wasn't too big of an issue, it seemed like, because he found another job really quickly. Unfortunately, this job was in New Jersey. So the couple moved over Memorial Weekend to New Jersey. They moved into a condo that was already fully furnished. So they ended up just putting all of Betty's stuff in a storage unit. Okay, side note. When I heard this, I thought it was really weird because they only put Betty's stuff in a storage unit. The condo's already fully furnished that they got in New Jersey. Where is John's stuff? Like, why does John not have any stuff? Is that not strange? So many questions. So anyway, they're living their life in New Jersey, shalala, when Betty finds something out really shocking. Maybe the reason John didn't have any stuff is because he actually owned a whole ass house in Connecticut and had for a really long time. I have no idea how Betty found out about John's secret home. Oh, but I can't even imagine how pissed she was. And by the way, this is no modest investment home that he rents out. This is no like family home that was passed down to him. This is a nice ass house. And when Betty confronts John, he tells her that he actually has a sister who's living in the home in exchange for dog sitting his two collies, which, by the way, Betty had no idea John even had two dogs, a sister, or a whole ass house in Connecticut. Betty insisted that John take her to see his house and meet his sister and his two dogs, and he agreed, but of course he put the trip off and blamed his busy work schedule. I'm so busy at work. John had one of those jobs where he supposedly had to travel out of town all the time. So life went on until it didn't. In August of 1991, Betty was just minding her own business when she was served divorce papers again. And just like last time, she was completely caught off guard. And to make it worse, this time, not only did John serve her divorce papers out of the blue, he actually took all of his stuff with him too from their condo. So Betty was livid. But as much as she was mad, there was also a part of her that didn't want to give up on the marriage. From what I can gather, this is mainly because this was her third marriage, so she really wanted to make things work. However, this time around, Betty's eyes were a bit more open to how much control John ultimately had over her life. So when he took off and threatened to divorce her this time, she realized she literally only had $50 to her name and had no idea where her storage unit with all her stuff in it was even located. She told John that if he came back and wanted to reconcile, she would, but these are the conditions that she had. She wanted to know where all her things were being stored at, which is so reasonable. She wanted her name added to the bank account and credit cards. She wanted to go to Connecticut to see his house and meet his sister. And her last condition for reconciliation was that she was going to get a job. She'd always worked, she wanted to work, and she just didn't want to be financially dependent on him anymore. Which, can you blame her? John stayed gone that entire weekend after Betty was served the divorce papers. He didn't call Betty, he didn't contact her, nothing. So Monday morning rolled around and Betty actually called John at work. And when she asked him where the fuck he was all weekend, he said that he'd been cooling off and sleeping in his car in New Jersey. They did ultimately reconcile. When she told him about her list of demands, he readily agreed. However, just like always, John kept putting off the trip to Connecticut and putting off getting everything done on Betty's list because he had to work his busy, busy work schedule. John did try to woo Betty, though, by arranging for them to go on a honeymoon finally. It was Labor Day weekend in 1991, but as soon as the trip started, it ended. Shortly after they got there, Betty slipped in the bathroom and broke her freaking hip. She had to go to the hospital and was immobile for a long time. It was awful. Looking back at the accident, a lot of people speculate that John might have staged it by putting water on the marble floor in the bathroom, hoping Betty would slip so that he could sue the hotel because that is just the kind of guy he was. So while Betty's hip was healing, she had very limited mobility. She spent a lot of time at home just talking on the phone and she would sew a lot. Well, on September 28th of 1991, Betty called her daughter Deanna. Remember, they were super close and they spoke on the phone almost every day because Deanna still lived in Houston, Texas. Deanna said that Betty was in really good spirits that day and rather excited. Betty had finally gained enough mobility to be able to get out of the condo. She told her daughter that her and John were going to pick out a gift for her grandson's birthday and then go out to dinner. But Deanna said her mom's mood shifted really quickly when John got home from work. She could actually hear the aggravation in Betty's voice as she bickered with John. And from what Deanna could hear, John had already gone to the store and bought a present for Betty's grandson, And that really pissed Betty off because she was excited to finally leave the house. She hadn't been able to get out and about for over 3 weeks. Betty told Deanna that she would call her on Monday and the women got off the phone. And that would be the last time anybody ever heard from Betty. When Monday rolled around, Deanna called her mom. No answer. Tuesday, no answer. So on Wednesday, when her mom didn't answer, Deanna actually called John at work and asked where her mom was. John told Deanna that he thought Betty was with her or visiting other family because he said that when he got home from work, he found a note from Betty that said something along the lines of, quote, feed the fish, I'll be back in a couple days, end quote. So he just naturally assumed that Betty was going to visit her daughter. Betty is recovering from a broken hip and is probably not supposed to be traveling right now. And when Deanna pressed John about how could Betty leave and travel on her own in the state that she was in, John explained that there was an airport bus stop directly in front of their condo and she probably got a ride to the airport there. When Deanna asked John where the note was now, he said, oh, I threw it away because I didn't think anything about it. Side note, I'm actually going to shorten Deanna's name to D for the rest of this episode because there's just a lot. So D immediately knew something was wrong because she was the last one to speak to her mom and she knew her mom wasn't visiting other family because, hello, she would have known. Plus, if Betty was visiting someone or went somewhere, she still would have called D. They literally talked every day about everything. Dee tried to get John to go to the police, but he just didn't want to and kept saying Betty would be mad and embarrassed by, quote, all of these theatrics when she gets back home, end quote. But he finally agreed to report Betty's disappearance because Dee said if John didn't do it, she was going to do it herself. So it's Friday, October 4th at 10 p.m. when John went to the police department after work and reported Betty missing. So her family assumes that she's been missing about 1 week at this point. John told police about the note that she'd left and that he really wasn't worried. He was under the impression that she was off visiting family, and he told the police that the weekend before she disappeared, they'd actually gone shopping. John did mention he wasn't sure how Betty was traveling because she left her car at home, but she did have a couple $100s, so she could have used that for travel expenses. A week later, the detective went to interview John around 8:30 at his condo. When asked if anything was missing from the condo when Betty left, John said that two jogger outfits were missing, a yellow suitcase, and her crutches. The detective asked John why she would have left her car at home, and John said that was because he'd taken her keys. She wasn't supposed to be driving with her hip injury. Then when asked why Betty didn't take the other car they had, John said that they'd both lost the keys to it. John always has an answer for everything. And remember, when John made the initial missing persons report, he said Betty only had like $200 to her name. In this second interview, he actually told police she had closer to $2,000 and possibly one of his credit cards. When the police asked if they had any marital problems, John said no. Before concluding the interview, the detective asked John for a photo of Betty, but John said he didn't have any because Betty was, quote, camera shy, end quote, which was just an outright blatant lie. Once the detectives followed up with Betty's family, it became obvious that Betty was not visiting her relatives. No one in her family had spoken to her since September 28th, which was completely out of character for her. The family also made it clear that they were very suspicious of John and mentioned that they had to practically make John report Betty missing. Because John wouldn't supply a photograph and made no attempt to find Betty, Betty's daughter and sister made and distributed hundreds of missing persons posters themselves with photos of Betty that they have, because she was not camera shy. She was stunning and she likely knew it. October 16th, 1991, police asked John to speak with them again. They ask him what he's doing to find Betty, and he actually lies and tells them that it was him who was responsible for the missing persons flyers. Of course, the detectives knew he was lying. When they asked him why he waited to report Betty, John couldn't come up with a reason. And when they asked him about his life before he met Betty, he told them something that no one actually really knew in Betty's family, and likely Betty hadn't known either. John had actually been married one time before. It was 20 years prior, and it was a very short-term marriage to a woman named Janice. Now, him and Janice had an amicable divorce, and the last time he saw her was in the 70s, before she moved to Florida to join a commune. A commune is a group of people that live together and share resources and responsibilities. Typically a cult. Next, police went to go speak with John's co-workers. And John's co-workers told investigators that they had no idea Betty was missing until they read it in the local paper, heard it on the news, and saw the missing persons flyers. John just continued to go to work and just didn't tell anybody anything was happening in his life. Eventually, when his co-workers asked him about it, he would tell them different stories to different co-workers, which is really weird to me. So, for example, he tells some people that Betty had a terminal illness, and then he would just straight up lie and tell other people that she came home. Just kind of whatever fit for the situation. Next, police spoke with Betty and John's neighbors. Unfortunately, most of the neighbors didn't really know or notice John and Betty, but two tenants actually said that they saw a very frail woman that matched her description trying to hurry down the staircase on crutches. She had bruises and marks on her face and body. Here's the discrepancy, though. One neighbor thought that they saw her doing this on the 28th, and the other neighbor couldn't remember if it was the 28th that they saw her or the 21st. So as suspicious and solidifying as it is to me, obviously this isn't something that police can go off as hard evidence. Police spoke with Betty's last boss, who said Betty complained about John sometimes and said that he was a jerk. Betty even asked her boss to hold on to the divorce papers John had served her in Florida. Remember, John told police that there was no marital issues. So, yet again, John is caught in another lie, and it's a pretty suspicious one for police. So here's the thing about John. He was committed to his story. He was extremely cool, calm, and collected. He seemed confident in his answers and versions of events. Just a natural-born liar. So John was always caught by police after he lied when they spoke to other people, and I think it was kind of shocking how good he was at bluffing. December 3rd, 1991, police asked John to do a polygraph, and he complies. The results of the polygraph are never disclosed to the public, but Betty's daughter, Dee, said John actually admitted to her shortly after that he had failed the polygraph test miserably. So police asked John to do a formal interview following the failed polygraph, and he agrees, but he puts them off for 2 weeks. December 18th, 1991, John finally goes to the police interview. It lasted several hours, during which John was cool, calm, and collected the entire time. When asked about the house in Connecticut, John didn't tell them that his sister lived there, which police knew was what he told Betty. He told police that a tenant named Kathy lived there. So far, the police were super suspicious, but they couldn't produce any evidence to arrest John on. So they decided to actually drive out to this house in Connecticut and kind of watch it. A woman was living there. When they ran her license plate, they said that the car wasn't registered to a Kathy or a Catherine. It was registered to a woman named Sheila Sauter. And when they asked around, they found out that she'd been living there 5 years and had a very awkward guy visit her. The man was described to have red hair and a bad haircut matching John Smith. When they looked into the property records, they saw that John did purchase the home in August of 1986 for $232,000. By the way, I did some research, and $200,000 in 1986 is equivalent to the purchasing power of around $545,930 in today's economy. So like I said, this is a nice-ass house. When police initially drove out to Connecticut and stake out the home, they did not alert Sheila to their snooping. First, they got a search warrant, and they executed it on January 3rd of 1992. When police arrived and told this Sheila woman that they were investigating the disappearance of Betty Fran Gladden Smith, she looked really confused. And that is because Sheila was not just a tenant or John's sister. Sheila had been John's girlfriend for 7.5 years, and she had no idea who the hell Betty was. Sheila did tell police that she hadn't seen John since December 18th, And while he was getting ready to leave for work at 5 a.m, he just casually mentioned to her, quote, "By the way, I'm married and my wife is missing," end quote, before he left for work. Okay, side note. When I heard that, I was so confused. So I've been married about the same amount of time Sheila and John have been together. And I could not imagine Matt telling me without explaining that he was married and his wife was missing. Obviously, the way John was able to juggle both women is he would blame it on work. He exaggerated his travel schedule and he made a shit ton of money. Plus, he was really manipulative. I mean, this guy is a true dirty John. Sheila said that she had met John at work in 1983. They worked for the same company, but in different capacities. And they were in a pretty serious relationship. She'd even gone to Ohio, where John was from, and met his entire family. When asked about the weekend of September 28th and 29th, Sheila said her and John went shopping for curtains. And she even had the receipt. Of course, police instantly made the connection. In one of John's interviews, he said that he'd been shopping that weekend, but he said that he'd been shopping with Betty. Sheila, again, like I said, she told police that she hadn't seen John since December 18th. And when police asked her to join in on their investigation and aid them with any information or anything she could do, she readily agreed. So it's February 23rd, 1992, when Betty's daughter Dee and Betty's sister Sherry fly to New Jersey to speak with police about the case. John had told both the women that they could actually stay at the condo he shared with Betty, and the woman took him up on this offer. Now, of course, Betty's family was really suspicious of John and didn't like him, but they knew to keep on his good side so that way they could gather as much information as possible. So when the women went to the condo, they actually went through the entire house from top to bottom while John was away. And a couple things struck them as odd. So most obvious was that all of Betty's belongings were there. Everything. Everything to get ready. Her entire wardrobe, jewelry, even things that like she never left the house with. For example, she had this comb that she absolutely adored that her mom gave her. And it was like something she always kept on her person so that she could quickly fix her hair. But I would say what was most shocking and alarming is, remember, John had told everybody that Betty left with a yellow suitcase. The suitcase belonged to a two-piece luggage set that Betty had. And Betty's daughter and sister actually found both pieces to this luggage set in a storage closet at John and Betty's condo. They did confront John, and he had no explanation other than Betty likely had the ability to repurchase everything she needed, and so she just didn't take luggage. John always had an answer, but not all of his answers were smart, no matter how calm and committed he was to the lie. For example, when the women asked John about the note Betty left, he said it wasn't actually a short scribble like he'd stated originally. It was in fact a very long letter, around 8 to 9 pages, but he didn't tell or show anybody what was in the letter because it was too personal. He was, however, willing to give the sister and daughter one random page of the letter straight from the middle. So, of course, they eagerly accepted this. However, when the women were reading the one page that John gave them, it didn't make sense. It didn't seem like it was from the middle of a heartfelt personal letter. It actually read like it was a diary entry. And when they asked to see the rest of it, he told them the rest of it was at his office at work. So the women pay a visit to police, tell them everything that they discovered while staying with John in the condo. The police shared their findings of John's long-term girlfriend, Sheila, that he'd once been married to a woman named Janice Hartman in the 70s. And so police and Betty's family start working together really well. When Dee and Sherry went home, they decided to look for Janice Hartman. Maybe she had some information about John that could help. Now, the search for Janice Hartman brings out so much more information. You will be so shocked. So tune in next week and we'll get into who Janice Hartman was, how her relationship with John is relevant, and conclude the crimes of John Smith. Thank you so much for tuning into Storytime Slayer Podcast, and I will talk to you next week.